Do you feel called to learn about science-faith integration and share what you learn with those around you? Join Reasons to Believe for an amazing trip to majestic Alaska from July 1st through 8th. If you'd like to hear more from and personally interact with Hugh Ross, Fuzz Rana, A.J. Roberts, Jeff Zwerink, and our special guest, Abdu Murray, from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, head on over to inspirationcruises.com/RTB to reserve your stateroom. It's an 8-day cruise to Alaska from July 1st through 8th. The scholars will be sharing original content with you and the entire group. There will be opportunities to personally interact with the scholars and the entire staff. There'll be a sense of community to interact with like-minded individuals who all share a heart for science faith evangelism. Registration now open. Sign up now. Go to inspirationcruises.com/RTB.
This program is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. Why can't all religions be true? You've heard that one before. How do you address it? Ken gives us a 3-point response to medical... Let's take it from the top. Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. Why can't all religions be true? You've heard that one before. How do you address it? Ken gives us a 3-point response to metaphysical pluralism on today's podcast. Ken, we've been talking about your book, God Among Sages, enjoying it thoroughly as we discuss the last two podcasts. Now we get into more of it as we really get into some more meat here. That's a common problem, question that all of us have heard probably at one point or another. Why can't all religions be true? In fact, most people would probably say, well, they are in some sense, right?
Yeah.
They're true. Come on. Yours is true. Mine is true. We all have part of the truth.
Or you have those who say none of them are true.
Or none are true or something
right.
like that. Let's just all learn to get along and go, you know, just go have a meal together.
Go have a beer.
Yeah, or something.
And I like the friend I had that had a little sign. Everybody has to believe in something. I believe I'll have another beer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't in my metaphysics class.
Yeah, so. You go. I went to a restaurant not long ago, and I asked for, I probably shouldn't say this on this podcast, I asked for a draft beer, and there were 130
different
ones. So I said, okay.
I'll have a Coke.
Yeah. Well, no, I ended up getting one, but we had to go down the list. So anyway, Ken, here we go.
I think what complicates this matter even more about religious pluralism, and obviously a plural is more than one, right? I think what complicates this very important question of whether all religions can be simultaneously true is that you kind of have a popular pluralism and then you have what I call a metaphysical pluralism. A popular pluralism basically says, look, we believe that all people ought to have the freedom of religious expression. So some people confuse these ideas. They take it to mean that social pluralism equals metaphysical pluralism. So social pluralism would be something like this. You should respect and tolerate diverse religious expression. Well, I believe in that. And by the way, so does the American Founding Documents. I believe that we ought to respect and tolerate, mm-hmm. as long as they're for the common good. I mean, if a person of a radical Islamic point of view comes over and wants to express his religious perspectives that are threatening to the lives of other people and of the republic, no, I don't think those views should be tolerated. But by and large, social pluralism, the idea that you should respect and tolerate religious expression, is a common American value. And I think it's a common Christian value that we don't believe Muslims or Hindus or Buddhists should be coerced to give up their faith or to give up their faith and embrace Christianity. But where people make a mistake is they think that social pluralism, which is nothing more than let's respect people's rights to practice their religion, they take that to mean that all religions are simultaneously true. So social pluralism implies metaphysical pluralism. I believe in social pluralism. As long as it's for the common good, I think people ought to be allowed to practice their religions as best they can. But that doesn't mean that those religions are actually metaphysically, that is, in terms of ultimately true. So that's really kind of the challenge, I think, that we deal with. Now, there are some people who would raise metaphysical pluralism, and they would say something like this. They would say, look, all religions or all ethical religions are simultaneously and ultimately true. And there are three fundamental problems with that idea. Now, people are going to come back at that issue with what I call kind of a philosophical pluralism. And I want to address a little bit of that as well. People like John Hick, the famous philosopher of religion, Joseph Campbell, who you've probably seen on PBS, who talked about all religions being true, has a very famous book on the topic. So we want to address that. But social pluralism is different than metaphysical pluralism. Social pluralism, let's allow religious expression. Let's respect people. The founding fathers were for it. I'm for it. Most Christians believe in it. But metaphysical pluralism, the idea that everything from Buddhism to Zoroastrianism is true, that has fundamental problems with it. And let's look at them. In my book, Chapter 9, I identify three fundamental problems with religious pluralism. The first one is quite simply that they are fundamentally different. They're saying fundamentally different things about the very nature of reality. We could put it in these terms: the world's religions are deeply divided. They're deeply divided. How so? Well, let's take the question of what is God? Some religions like Judaism and Islam are monotheistic. Other religions like Shintoism and popular Hinduism are polytheistic. I think I said in a previous program that there's a popular form of Hinduism that believes in 330 million different deities. You also have within Hinduism, Advaita Hinduism. They believe the universe is God. And then the original form of Buddhism, known as Theravada or Theravada Buddhism, it's atheistic. So is God one? Is God more than one? Is God the universe? Is God none? All of those are held within the world's religious leaders. They fundamentally cannot agree as to what God is. It's expressed even in a greater concern as it goes forward. Who is God? Judaism and Islam say God's personal. Christianity disagrees. Christianity says God is more than personal. He's triune. Believing in the Trinity, one God in three persons, that's more than merely personal. But when you go to, for example, forms of Hinduism and Buddhism, they say God is not a person at all. So we don't know what God is. We can't agree on who God is. What's God's relationship to the world? I think Islam implies that Allah is virtually totally transcendent. Some would say, no, they believe in some kind of immanence, but it's many of us get draw the conclusion that Allah is totally apart from this world. other religions, like some of the Eastern mystical religions, they say God is totally immanent in the world. And then Christianity says God is both transcendent and immanent in different ways. Can't agree on God's relationship to the world. How about our fundamental problem? I mean, most religions are trying to get at the fundamental human condition. What's the fundamental problem? Well, Christianity says it's sin. And the Greek word hamartia means to miss the mark, like an archer would point at a target and the arrow would miss. Maybe a more popular definition of sin is that we break the commandments of God, so we're lawbreakers. Or there are other biblical descriptions of sin. But, you know, in Buddhism, it's not sin. It's desire. It's attachment. In Hinduism, it's an unenlightened. We're gods, but we're suffering from a cosmic amnesia. We don't remember that we're God.
Mm.
I don't think we could differ more about what the problem is. And if you can't agree on the problem, there's no way to agree on the solution. Is the solution faith and repentance? Is it obedience? Is it meditation? So the first fundamental problem with the idea that all religions can be true is that the religions are deeply divided, and these are not secondary issues. It's not like Presbyterians and Methodists differing over predestination. It's not like Lutherans and Baptists differing over who should be baptized. These are fundamental elements of what we think about God and what we think about how God relates to the world. Now a second defeater. I'm going to use that word.
Before you move on, there's something nagging at me, and that is, there is this question that I'm sure you address elsewhere, but I want to bring it out here, and that is, why bother with religion at all?
Yeah.
I'm not saying be an atheist, although maybe that's the implication, but why is religion important? Why is having the idea that there is a God or not a God, why is it important? What are we trying to get at by having religion?
Well, I think Christians historically would say that God has revealed himself.
Well, yeah.
And that the practice of Christianity, which involves both beliefs and moral values and a way of life, is by and large a religion. Now, there are some people who say, you know, I don't believe in religion. I just believe in a relationship with Jesus. And then when I start asking them questions, they sound very religious to me. And James says that, you know, we should practice the true religion.
Right.
So Christianity can be seen as a religion. If somebody asked me, well, what is Christianity? My answer would be it's three things. It is a set of beliefs, it is a collection of values, and it's a way of life. And I think primarily in that order. But
could you say that's... those are three characteristics of any religion? Their attempt at answering those three components?
Some religions don't have a lot of clear set of beliefs.
Okay.
Most of them have a collection of values. Most of them are trying to get at kind of how do I live my life. So by and large, that's kind of a broad description.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you could take the word religion out and put a philosophy of life,
right.
You know, kind of these broader categories. So, you know, even the atheist is asking what's true, what's real, how should I live?
They're also trying to answer the big questions. Why are we here?
The big questions of life, yeah.
Why is there something rather than nothing?
Yeah. Questions about the ultimate. What lies in death?
As soon as you engage in those questions, though, now you're inevitably going to lead to some answers that are going to be the foundations of some religion.
I think if you think of philosophy as asking and trying to answer the big questions of life, you are inevitably involved in some kind of religious discussion.
Yeah.
And you know, religion, the Latin word religare, has to do with being bound to something. I think inevitably to be a thoughtful, reflective human being is to ask the deep questions. And often those are tied to religion.
Right.
You mentioned in a previous podcast that we all have this religious impulse. Yeah. Homo religiosus, I think you've mentioned in yet another podcast, is the Latin term.
That's exactly right. I mean, and of course, if it's true that being made in the image of God makes us worshipers by nature, and again, I would add not only the Genesis 1 discussion of being made in the image and likeness of God, but if we're worshipers, Paul seems to indicate that, and this has very important application to the world's religions, when we don't worship the true and living God, we worship nature. We worship the created things.
Instead of the creator.
The creation rather than, or the creature instead of the creation.
Right.
And if that's the fallen sense, then it's going to be very easy to see that the world's religions will inevitably be caught up in idolatry. And I think that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that apologetic response on the part of Christianity is so critical.
Let me just one further comment, and that is that if as responsible and thoughtful human beings, we're going to reflect on the big questions of life, mm-hmm. and that the response or answer and attempts to answer those entail religion, then it makes sense to examine the different religions, the different answers
yeah.
that people give, and compare them and deal with this question of, are all legitimate answers or are some of them not legitimate answers? I guess there was kind of a logical flow there that I was...
Yeah, I think trying to track with your point there, I think that... you know, Christians have what we call comparative religion.
Right.
And we compare these religions to Christianity and we talk about them. As we discussed in a previous show, two previous shows, I think the Bible gives us these 12 principles to help us shape the way we view other religions.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, anybody who is considering ultimate issues... they may opt for secularism, some form of atheism, or they may say, I just have to be skeptical, I don't know, or agnostic. Or they're going to say, maybe there's a religious option, now which one? I mean, I've had people come to me and say, you know, I think I want to be a monotheist. Should I be a Jew, a Christian, or a Muslim?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had other people who've had... what they think is some kind of mystical experience, and they say,
"What? How do I explain this?
How do I understand that?
Mm-hmm.
And if it came in another religion, how does that possibly relate in Christianity?"
Just one, I can't resist making a further comment, and that is that if you remember Hugh's testimony, he came from a non-religious home.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly atheistic, but just non-religion. But he studied astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was evidence from astronomy at the time that he was studying that the universe had a beginning. And so it was natural for him to ask the question, are there any other sources of information, and in particular in the area of religious systems, that agree with this or comport with it? And so he asked the question, what do these different religions say? Do they agree with this? And can we find correspondence? And that's what led him to examine, you know, these major religious books, and eventually including the Bible.
In fact, at Biola University, I teach a class there entitled World Religions and Science. And that class has now become part of the Reasons Institute courses we offer here. And it is a course that looks at the world's religions and then asks, how do they appeal to science to justify their worldview?
Right.
Are, you know, are they very on the antithesis of science, or do they appeal to science? Islam, for example, often Muslim scholars consider Islam to be the most scientific oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So that question of the big question, science is a way of knowing. Mm-hmm. How does then that relate to these other religious
sources of knowledge?
Sources of knowledge, yeah. Yeah. Now, we are looking here at religious pluralism, mm-hmm. and we've made the first point that the world's religions are divided. I mean, they're saying different things, and they're saying different things about major issues. They can't agree on what God is or who God is, or even if there is a God, they can't agree on the human problem. They can't agree on the solution. These are the major issues.
Mm-hmm. The big questions.
They don't differ on issues like baptism or how to look at eschatology. These are the very issues that define who God is and God's relationship mm-hmm. to the world. Now, a second problem is that the world's religions are irreducible. Now, what I mean by that is that you might be tempted to say maybe there's a way of making the religions true, and that is boil them all down to their lowest common denominator. And maybe in that way we can have all religions be true. The problem, however, is there's no agreement that there really is a lowest level in which they all agree upon. The problem is that it really doesn't comport. When you look at the religions and analyze them, there isn't just one theme where they all fit perfectly. Now, inevitably, people will ask the question, well, what about common ethics?
Like the golden rule or something.
Yeah, because if you look at Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, they all have a very similar ethic. That is, they kind of have the second half of the Ten Commandments. Don't act in an illicit, sexual, immoral manner. Don't lie. Don't steal. These kind of basic moral principles.
Mm-hmm.
The golden rule, right? In fact, Confucius, the great Chinese teacher, he said 500 years or more before the birth of Christ, what you don't want people to do to you, don't do to them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes called the silver rule, right? Because Jesus puts it in the positive. Not only are we to don't do to others what you don't want to do to you, but do to others.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in the positive. Act positively. Treat others the way you want to be treated. The problem, though, is even though there is some common ethics, and we would anticipate that from a biblical Christian point of view, all people are made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
They have a conscience. They have general revelation. These are reasons why they would recognize certain moral principles. But here is the fundamental problem. You can't reduce them. I remember when I could help my kids with their math, we would take fractions, you know, and you get the denominator mm-hmm. equal on all of them, and then you can work your mathematics, right? You can mm-hmm. reduce them down to the lowest common denominator. The problem here is that even with ethics, the ethics of the religions are connected to fundamentally different metaphysical truth and claims about God.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the idea of treating people with respect. In a Christian context, that's rooted in the idea that people are made in the image of God. Or that Christians are saved by grace through faith. Even the good works we do are understood within the context of salvation, within the context of Jesus being the divine Savior. So Christians argue we're not saved just by being moral. We respond to God's commandments out of our love for Him and obedience. But other religions, they may have a very different view. You can't reduce religion to ethics, because religion provides the foundation for why we live ethically. And Houston Smith said it well. He said, look, whenever you, in fact, I have the quote here. It's a good one worth quoting. Houston Smith is an expert on the world's religions. Anybody who's probably studied world religions in the Western world has come across Houston Smith's book. I like his books very much. He says, for as soon as the notion of sameness moves beyond vague generalities, every religion has some version of the golden rule. It founders on the fact that the religions differ in what they consider essential and non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. So you can't reduce religion down to ethics, because religion provides the metaphysical foundation for ethics themselves. So thirdly, one, the religions are divided. Two, the religions are irreducible. And now the third, which I think is the most devastating of the three, the world's religions are contradictory. The formal laws of logic illustrate that all religions can't be true. Let me give you a very specific example. Let's take the Christian view of Jesus and compare it with the Muslim view of Jesus. The Christian view of Jesus says Jesus is God incarnate. That's who he is. He is a single person who possesses both a divine and human nature. He is God in human flesh. That's central to Christianity. That's part of the historic Christian creeds. What do Muslims say? They say the opposite. They say Jesus is not God incarnate. He might have been a human prophet, but there's one thing they know that he's not. He's not God incarnate. Well, let's take the law of non-contradiction. Two contradictory statements cannot be both true because they negate each other. So if you say Jesus is God incarnate, that means it's false that he's not. Or if you say it's true that he's not God incarnate, it's true that he is. So since Islam and Christianity differ on the fundamental nature of Jesus, they can't both be true. And then you could even throw the Jewish position in there. The Jewish position may be that Jesus was a false prophet. Mm-hmm. So the law of non-contradiction illustrates that all these religions can't be true. It's not possible for there to be one God and be 330 million gods in the same way and in the same respect. Now, obviously, Christians say God is one in essence, but three in person. But what we're saying there is that the way God is one, he's not three, and the way he's three, he's not one. There's no violation of in the same time and in the same way. By the way, we can add another logical law, and that's the law of excluded middle, and it says either or. So we look at the question, is Jesus God incarnate or is Jesus not God incarnate? He's either one or the other. It's either he is or he's not. So the law of non-contradiction not only tells you that both of the Jewish and Muslim views of Jesus can be true, they can't both be true, and one of them is true and the other's not. And the contradictions run very, very far. So I would argue the idea that all religions are true, simultaneously true, faces three obstacles, three defeaters. There is no way to really reconcile these kinds of things. Now, having said that, and I want to make sure either you guys have a question about that.
What about the elephant analogy?
Very good. That's where I want to go.
Okay.
All right.
I want to go in that direction. Now, some people would say, look, there is a way of working through all of this. And maybe the best example of a philosophical pluralist is the very distinguished philosopher of religion scholar, John Hick. Professor Hick was British born. During World War II, he was part of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, became a scholar, came to America, taught at Princeton. Then had a shift. You know, it's interesting. Sometimes people have shifts in their thinking. John Hick was an evangelical. He's writing things, working with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. I mean, some of us have been part of InterVarsity. I've written things for InterVarsity Press, you know, and things of that nature. Very evangelically oriented campus ministry often. Well, Professor Hick, when he came to Princeton, he had a shift in his thinking. And he became more liberal in the way he thought, which happens to people, right? I was thinking just last night when I was driving home that my intention is to die an Orthodox Christian.
Right.
I don't have any intention
to make a shift.
To make a shift, you know.
Stay away from the peanuts we have over here.
I don't want people to say, well, what's Ken Sample's view? Well, it depends on what book.
Yeah.
His earlier book, he says this. Now over here, he says that.
There's another guy that I just read. He died here just not too long ago. He wrote on inerrancy.
Yeah.
What's his name again? I just can't remember his name. And he ultimately was writing on the openness of God theology.
Was it Clark Pinnock?
Pinnock.
Clark Pinnock.
Pinnock.
He had a shift.
He made a major shift.
He made a major shift. And that probably, Joe, that's a topic we ought to take on in a major podcast and look at the reality that people make shifts. They change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
I have changed my mind about certain things, but it's nothing related to the Apostles' Creed.
Right.
Now, with all due respect, Professor Hick, who has now passed away, he left Princeton and came to Claremont School of Theology. He taught philosophy and
religion.
Right
down the freeway here,
right down
the
freeway, just right down the 10 freeway, just, 20 minutes away, maybe? He taught there for many, many years, and Professor Hick became kind of the leading intellectual figure defending the idea that you could have a religious pluralism, that you could argue for all religions being true. Now, he's rejecting two things. On one hand, he's rejecting the idea of skepticism. Dave brought up, you know, what about the religions being false? He said, no, that there's something to religion. There's an ultimate reality. And so skepticism and secularism he rejected. But he looked back at his Christian roots and he said, I have to reject the dogmatism of Christianity. And what he argued for is a religious pluralism. Now, let me develop the idea a little bit. Professor Hick picked up on a story that's very famous among the Eastern mystical religions. It's called the elephant story or the elephant analogy. And I'm sure many of our listeners know it or they've heard me talk about it. But it's the old idea that one of the kings, maybe in China or in India, brought together six blind men. These men had been blind from birth. So they've never seen the world. They've never had vision. And he brings them in, and he brings an elephant into their midst, and he has the six men touch different parts of the elephant and ask them, now, what is that? So one of the men touches the tusk, and the other touches the leg, and the other touches the trunk. I remember presenting this topic in my Sunday school class, and my son, Michael, who was a thinker even as a young kid, he said, Dad, there are parts of an elephant I don't want to touch. I said, cogent point, son. And the king then says, you know, what do you think? So the man who touches the tusk, he says, well, you know, this is kind of, it seems to me, what I know of the farmers using a plow shear. Another man touches the leg and says, it seems like a pillar. You know, I've been
tree.
In the temple where it's this. And the other who touches the trunk says, it seems like what I have come to know in the fields, like a snake. And so the story is that all of these people are describing the same phenomenon, but from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is maybe human beings, in their prejudices, in their limitations, in their inabilities, are touching different, having different experiences with God and describing the same reality, but all from their own different points of view. Now, I can't tell you how, Joe, using a story.
It's very appealing.
Using an analogy, a story gets people, hey, wait a second here. Because the reality is, hey, wait a second. We are dealing with a mysterious God. We are dealing with a God who can't be fully known. And we do know that people have cultural perspectives and biases and all of those kinds of things. And so why can't this story be true? And again, I stop and think, you know, some of my favorite writers like C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, one of the things that makes them powerful is to take an engaging story and really get people to think about issues. I mean, Jesus would take a parable. I mean, we're still debating exactly how those parables of Jesus mm-hmm. are to be understood in every context. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're moved by different yeah. sides of those types of parables.
Even the Bible,
parables.
Paul the Apostle says, we know in part.
That's right. Wait, look, this is a God that is beyond our capacity to fully understand. So where we begin is, there's some good points here. These are points that are well within our consideration. Now, how does Hick interpret this? He says all religions encounter the unknowable God. He says the different religions represent different faces or masks of God. Part of the misunderstanding is they're touching different parts of God. Part of it is their own cultural, you know, differences that they have. And then thirdly, he would say religious pluralism is superior to both skepticism, secularism, and dogmatism, conservative Christianity.
Mm.
Now, what I think we need to do, however, is to do a very careful analysis of the analogy, and I think the analogy starts to come apart once we begin to scrutinize it. I actually think one of the fundamental problems with this analogy is it implies a radical skepticism about God. I think what Hick is saying is nobody can know God. That is, I think what you should rather draw from this analogy is that nobody knows God, that nobody really can know God. Rather than all religions are true, I think this analogy could possibly be drawn that none of the religions are true, that it really does imply an unknowable God. And I mean, Hick says that straight up, that nobody really can know God.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the question comes, and we philosophers like to ask these questions, and I mean it with no disrespect to Professor Hick. Personally, I wish I could have studied under Professor Hick. I think he was amazingly insightful, and I've actually come to the conclusion that you can learn from people who hold very different points of view. I mean, Dave, Albert Einstein might have been a pretty good person to study under, even though he was not a Judeo-Christian. He had a Jewish background, but he was largely kind of secular, or he kind of left, you know, kind of metaphorical statements about mm-hmm. God, doesn't play dice with the universe. Whether he meant that in a theological way, I think, is open to question. But a point I'm making here is, you know, a lot of times as an apologist, we feel like we have to kind of, you know, we have to show where people are wrong. I actually think Hick thought a lot about this question, and his thinking has actually, in many ways, helped me to try to work out a response. So I say this not in any kind of smart aleck type of way, but the question I would ask is, if God is unknowable, then how does a particular philosopher know so much about God? I mean, if God is unknowable, and Hick draws that position, Hick ultimately kind of adopts an unknowable pantheism. So when he argues that all religions are true, even in his own way, he ends up with kind of an exclusive choice. But think about it. I mean, to say God is unknowable, you have to know a lot about God to know that access is denied. So when you say nobody can know God, my immediate question is, how do you know that?
Right.
And this is a problem with this kind of analogy. Philosophers, even wise philosophers, can't know an unknowable God. And it does seem to imply that all the religions are false. So taken to its logical conclusion, I would say this analogy proves the opposite of what Professor Hick wants it to prove. He wants it to prove that all religions are true. I would say it proves that none of the religions are true. Now, notice, too, that this analogy could probably work if you got the Judeo-Christian religions out. In fact, you might have to take Islam out as well. But notice this. Pluralism says all religions are true, but Christianity says that's not true. And they say, well, then Christianity is false. But I thought all religions are true. Mm. In order for religious pluralism to be true, Christianity has to be false.
Well, there's another aspect, too. Maybe it's related. And that is that Christianity claims to be a revelation from God. So it's saying God is revealing himself. So it's a direct contradiction to his conclusion, which is that God can't be known, or that all of these religions are true in the sense that they at least reveal some aspect of God. But if what they reveal in their various aspects of God are contradictory to the revelation, the full revelation that we see claimed in Christianity.
And of course, to say that
it's inconsistent.
To say that God can't be known means God can't reveal himself.
That's right.
So in many ways, notice this logical dilemma.
Yeah.
All religions are true, but Christianity can't be true.
Right. You got to kick it out.
Christianity is this God who reveals himself,
right.
This God who makes himself known. So we start taking the elephant analogy apart, and we realize, it's not going to work. Yeah. It's not going to work as easily as we thought.
The elephant starts stomping around a little bit. It's not too happy.
Well, you can't have the elephant. The elephant's gone now, and the guys are down there probing. Where's the elephant?
Well, what I would say, my comeback is that if it was a Christian story, the elephant would be Jesus, and he would heal the blind men and allow them to see that he's the Son of the Father.
Right.
So you have a different point of view. Now at that point, now notice what Hick is trying to do. He's trying to say maybe there's a way of altering, maybe there's a way of understanding. But essentially, we could come back and say, but Professor Hick, you seem to have the same problems. You seem to still have religions that all don't know God. And
well, they don't know God completely. I guess the elephant analogy is that each one of them is describing some, perhaps correctly, some aspect of the elephant. So each religion, in his view, is describing some aspect of God that is correct. So they're true in that limited sense.
But in a sense, but in that very same sense, they still don't know God.
No, they don't know the whole elephant.
They don't know the elephant. And so they're still in that situation of kind of groping. And, even with that small understanding that might be true, they don't have a coherent way of saying, and here is the integration of all of those kinds of things.
And he doesn't even have that.
No, he doesn't.
Who's attempting
to
integrate them.
Now let me introduce Joe.
Well, plus I was going to say, aren't you also essentially just, you're disrespecting the religions because you're not taking them very seriously. These religions are making truth claims. But you're essentially saying, I'm lumping you all together. I'm hand waving here. But Christianity is saying that this is the true religion. We're exclusively true. Islam also says it's the true religion. But you're saying that they're all true, but they can't all be true. But you're trying to make this analogy work, so you're not taking them seriously. So you're disrespecting them to make the analogy work. So that's not being charitable to these religions.
Yeah.
So you might be a nice person and a fine philosopher. I didn't know the man, but you're not really taking the religion seriously, it seems to me.
And I think that's part of that second element, that to reduce them down is to lose their appeal. I mean, the reason why people are attracted to the religion is because of their diverse points of view. I mean, people like elements of the unique Hinduism, the unique Buddhism. So if you kind of boil them all down, they lose their flavor. They lose the very attractive features that people are attracted to. So you're right. I think it is boiling down. Now, let me introduce you to another Christian thinker that takes it from that very point. This is Joseph Campbell. Campbell wrote a book entitled The Power of Myth. And all you need to do is go on YouTube and watch some of the lectures that Professor Campbell gave with
On PBS.
On PBS. He used to work for Lyndon Johnson.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I'll think of it here in a moment.
He was a former pastor.
That's right. Very liberal in his ultimately his points of view. Now, this is what Campbell says. A very interesting way. He says, all religions make mythical or poetic claims, not historical factual truth claims. So he says, therefore, all religions, like mythology overall, are metaphorically true, but literally false.
Wow.
So the way you can make religions true is they're poetic. So they are in metaphor true, literally false. Poetically true, factually false. Now, I have to tell you, philosophers can be pretty clever people, right? This again raises the question that maybe we have to look at differently. Maybe all they're doing, I mean, you never read Shakespeare, you never read poetry and say, that's false. No, it doesn't make a factual claim. You might not be moved by it, or you may think, wow, that's the greatest thing I ever read. But if something is a metaphor, if something is mere poetry, it's not true or false. You know, it might be beautiful or it may not be beautiful, but this is a very interesting way. Campbell argues we should understand the religion the way we understand mythology. It is only a metaphor. It's only a poem. And in that way, it's true, but factually and historically, it's false. Again, I appreciate Hick and Campbell because they, I think, are very creative in the way they've come at this, and they demand from us a lot of thought and reflection as to how to respond to it. My way of looking at this is to say that that's not true with Christianity. With Judaism and with Christianity, it is not mere poetry. It is not merely a mythical story. In fact, Peter says in his epistle, you know, we have not followed
cleverly devised
stories.
Fables.
And you know what the Greek word is? Mythos. Christianity explicitly says it's not myth. It says that Jesus has come into the time-space world. He's a historical person. And there are Greek and Roman individuals living in the first century who mention him. So God Christianity is not mere poetry. It's not mere metaphor.
You treat a person like Campbell very respectfully.
Yeah.
I tend to more think of him like a used car salesman. I feel like I'm being sold a bill of goods.
Well, you are. you are. And what I would say is, I think though that what they do for us, what Professor Hick and what Professor Campbell did for us, is they challenged us. And by challenging, it made us go deeper to say, wow, that's an interesting challenge they've raised. Mm-hmm. Now, how would we go about, you know, dealing with that kinds of issue? And I would even say a further element. I don't know the state of Hick and Campbell's heart. I think both of them ultimately probably held an unknowable God, kind of like a pantheistic Hinduism. I think, interestingly, that's where they both ended up. But notice, in order to answer this questions of all religions being true, you have to ultimately end up with a God who can't be known. And how can you know anything about this God that can't be known? Now, so one of the ways of responding to Hick is to say, Jesus was a historical person. Jesus came into the world. Peter says, we didn't follow fables and myths and legends. Jesus is a man of history. We can trust what we're told in the epistles and the gospels. And so God is not unknowable. God has come in the flesh. You could look into the eyes of Jesus. Jesus says, I'm the Son of the Father. To know me is to know the Father. In fact, Jesus says, to know me is to be loved by my Father. I mean, the thing that people got irritated about Jesus is that he went around talking and acting as if the way you treat him is the way you treat God himself.
Hmm.
Buddha never did that. Muhammad never did that. Confucius never did that. So you have fundamental problems. Christianity and Judaism are historical religions. Islam is a historical religion. They introduce an unknowable God. And I think that what we see is this exclusivity in Christianity. Here's a couple things Jesus says. I and the Father are one. I and the Father are one. Again, the Jews picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus said to them, I've shown you many great miracles from my Father. For which of these do you stone me? We are not stoning you for any of these, replied the Jews, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God.
Wow.
You know, Luke says in the beginning of his gospel, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitness and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also for me to write out an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. The Bible, the New Testament, says that God has appeared in the flesh. That Christianity is historical. It's not mere poetry. It's not mere metaphor. That God can be known in Christ. And Christ says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me, John 14:6. Peter says in Acts 4:12, salvation is found in no one else. For there is no other name under heaven given to men by which we must be said. Be saved. Notice the exclusivity of language there. Here's another passage from Paul. For in Christ all the fullness of deity lives in bodily form. Here's John again. Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life, but whoever rejects the Son will not see life, for God's wrath remains on him. I reject religious pluralism. I think that it is incoherent. I think that It is contrary to historic Christianity. And so the idea, to come back, Dave, to your idea that God has revealed himself, I think it is very, very much a viable belief that there is one true religion and that Christianity is that religion because it has explanatory power, because it possesses a certain coherence, and that it's rooted in history and in fact. And so it's important because, again, we live in a very postmodern time. We live in a time, I think, frankly, where we live in a time where it's politically correct to say all religions are true, or to put it in the negative, to say your religion is true and everybody else's is false. That's seen as intolerant and bigoted. This tells me that it's very critical for us to have an awareness of these things and to be able to have a conversation and to be able to present an apologetic response. And so I don't think there's a better time or a more needed time for us to be sophisticated in the way we think, not only about our faith, but in how we think about other faiths. And, you know, the reason I wrote this book is I've had these kind of conversations. I've talked with people who've raised these kinds of issues. But, you know, it is the challenges. I mean, you know, sometimes we ask ourselves, why didn't God make it much more clear? Or we ask ourselves, you know, why does life have to be so complicated or so difficult or so painful? And my response is that God has a purpose. And, you know, heresies are very serious things. To believe in a heresy from a historic Christian point of view is to hold a belief that is so contrary to the faith that it actually reinterprets the faith. It distorts the faith. And, you know, there have been heresies that come along. I mean, the first four chapters of my book talk about the different heresies that challenged Christianity. But, you know, Arius did us a favor because the church fathers said, this guy's made a very serious charge, a dangerous charge, and we need to come and respond to it. And, you know, I think that it is possible that things aren't so simple because that's the way God wants us to dig in. He wants us to dig deeper. Just like, you know, I mean, I was thinking the other day, wouldn't it be nice if I had all the money in the world and I didn't have to work and I didn't have physical pains and, you know, health issues and everything was perfect with my children? Wouldn't that be a wonderful life? But, you know, if all that were true, I probably wouldn't cling to God. I think I like to say, in fact, I wrote a recent Reflections article where I talk about what we can hold on to when it comes to times being tough. And one of the points I made in the article is that I think suffering is a severe mercy. It's severe. I mean, gosh, I know people who have serious health problems. I know people who have family members with serious health problems. I know people who've lost jobs. I know people that have suffer with mental health challenges. I mean, these are very difficult. It's hard to know how to handle some of these types of issues. But Joe and Dave, what I can say is that these are severe, but they're also mercies because it doesn't seem like there's anything like suffering that causes people to cling to God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now some people come along and say, well, that's the thing that made me give up God. But I would argue that maybe these challenges, you know, heresies, these people who come along and say, well, you know, Jesus is just one more prophet. You know, we have all these religious figures. You know, I remember when I first started writing this book, I thought about faces in a crowd, religious faces. Right. You know, we see these different faces and they all seem to be equivalent. I think God allows challenges in our theology and in our life and allows suffering in the world because it is his way of getting us to depend upon him. Mm-hmm. And so the Hicks, the Campbells, the people who challenge us, yeah, they are teaching things that are false. They have departed from historic Christianity, but they do us good if we are then able to respond to it and say Christianity is still true. Even with those objections, we have shown that those are not defeaters to the truth of historic Christianity. So, as I've mentioned before in other podcasts, I've never been much of a salesman trying to push my books. But you know, I what I'm saying now is buy two of them.
Yes,
because
get a couple of copies at least.
You need to read one of them, take notes in it, and then you need another to give to your son or your daughter, your next door neighbor.
We were debating at lunch whether print or ebook is preferable, and I think most of us still prefer print books. Although you were saying that you got chided for preferring print over ebooks.
Yes, although if somebody's going to hit me with a book, I'd rather it be an electronic book.
Well, if it's a Kindle, it could.
Yeah, but that's not the book. Yeah. That's just the cover.
That's
the device. Yeah.
And then, how are you going to leave your electronic book to your kids?
I know that's a problem.
Yeah, God Among Sages. Get a couple of copies at least, and order here at reasons.org. All right, Ken, this has been a great series thus far. We're not done yet. We're going to pick it up next time with more fun. I wanted to tease a possible future topic.
Sure.
You know, you're mentioning Hick and Joseph Campbell. Here's my question for a possible future subject. It seems to me that there's been a lot of harm done by liberal Christianity. Mm. I wonder which is worse, liberal Christianity or atheism? Have we done a topic on that, on either straight thinking in the past or probably not?
No, I don't think we ever have.
That might be a good topic. Yeah. Which is worse, liberal Christianity or atheism?
Pick your poison, right?
So I'm putting it in your head now.
Okay.
Maybe we could do
that. Sparks something.
Yeah. Anyway, great stuff. Thank you for that. Pick up a couple of copies of God Among Sages, Ken's brand new book. It is eminently readable. You will enjoy it. And as we've been mentioning, this is a time in which you need to be equipped to engage all the people around you. As you know, people are coming to your doorstep, as Ken has been talking about, a mission field right at your doorstep. And it's a great time to be able to know how to talk about these things in a winsome manner. So learn how to do that by getting a copy of God Among Sages. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthlypartners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.